All right, gentlemen. Okay, so a little bit of history for this class period, and it will not be completely comprehensive, but I hope to give you a general picture of the way some things shifted. And this is the part of the class where I am on my front porch shaking my head and my cane at what the young people are doing. It's going to sound like I am just a complete curmudgeon about all technology. I'm not, necessarily. What I am is somebody who I think is increasingly concerned, not just that we have technology, but we aren't asking any questions about whether it's good or whether it's helpful in moral ways. The only question we ask is, can we do it? I'll give you an example. There's two kinds of people in this world. When you walk into a friend's house like I did a few weeks ago, and he said, "Hey, Alexa, turn on the lamp," which was 2 feet away from him, and it turned on. And there's the kind of person that thinks that is so cool, and the kind of person that thinks that is so sad. I am the latter of those two people. I used to be the former of those two people. If you are the person that thinks that's so cool, you may find this next part challenging. If you are the person that thinks that's so sad, then we're going to cry together because I'm going to talk about how we got to a place where we find it difficult to get up and move 2 feet to turn a lamp on. The Industrial Revolution started in essentially the mid-1700s. There were motivations, obviously, to find easier ways to do things. Now, on the face of it, does it sound like it's a good thing to find easier ways to do things? Of course, right? We want easier ways to do things. Is that an infinitely good principle? No. It is not always good to find easier ways to do things. And one of the reasons it's not always good to find easier ways to do things is if you take away all of the work, then you also take away all the benefits from the work. And those benefits are particularly in the realm of moral gain. So, the mass production comes along. And now, in many ways, machines, production lines, and so forth are able to produce things wildly more efficiently. I don't mean just a little bit more efficiently. I mean to the point that now it makes no sense in anyone's mind to continue to make things the way we used to. So, for instance, it talks about the spindle in Proverbs chapter 31. That is a woman, not just with a loom making fabric. She is actually, a loom is making thread to put into the loom to make the fabric, right? So we're talking at a fundamental level, she is making the clothes. Now, it also talks about her buying fabric, so there is some of that. But, she is creating from the ground up, from scratch, those clothes. Well, the Industrial Revolution comes along, and now all of that is relatively automated. And you just can't keep up, right? There's no way on your best day that you can come close to producing the amount of fabric or even the quality of fabric. You know, in America in the 1700s on into the 1800s after the Industrial Revolution, you still have people making their own clothes, but you could tell somebody had made their own clothes. They called it homespun because the thread that they make was not near as consistent as the thread that a machine could make. And so you had kind of bigger lumps of cotton here and there in those clothes. And so it didn't look as nice. It didn't look as refined. And so it wasn't just that they were producing it at a faster rate, even a higher quality. How do you compete with that? Why would you compete with that, right? Because not only can I go buy the fabric now, I can buy better quality fabric, and it's not just that it's produced faster, but cheaper. So why would I keep producing something that I can just go buy at the Walmart for 10 cents or the general store or whatever it is, right? So now what's happened is a lot of the things that people were doing and producing in their homes have become obsolete. You used to have a wheelwright in a community. Wagon wheels get broken, that's the guy you go to. That's what he does. He's got pieces and parts of that, and he'll measure that out, and he'll make you a wheel. He's got, you know, metal. Maybe he's even got to go to the forge to get the blacksmith to make the ring that goes around the wheel, right? Even before wagons went out, the wheelwright was already losing his place because factories were making even those wheels. But then, of course, by the time the car goes along, now we're done with it. And we look at that and we go, look, I mean, it's just progress. And it is. And I'll just say, I'd rather ride in a car than a wagon. And so don't think that at any point I'm saying, oh, times were better. I don't think they were better in every way. I do think that what we've lost sight of is they were better in some ways. All right? That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that every technological advance, like I hate air conditioning. But I'll tell you this. When I first went to Fiji, I did not see a single air conditioner in a single home. Wouldn't you say? Or most? Down in Dinarao, sure, right. Not a home that I went into. Now they're starting to be in the homes. I know. Which I was thankful for. Do you think Fiji's getting morally better with that? I don't think it means just the air conditioner. I just mean...
With the advancements?
Yeah. No. Is it a more wholesome place? No. I don't want to be up here self-righteously standing next to people who have not had air conditioning and say, you shouldn't have the air conditioner. But I do want to say, with all of that advancement, comes a moral cost. So we moved all of the manufacturing and so forth out of the home. And so guess what? The men have to leave the home, or at least they feel like they have to. They got to go get jobs where the jobs are, which is in the factories and in the offices. It's not at home anymore because that's not going to make you any money. And some of them left because the thing that they were doing at home had become obsolete. Some of them left because that paycheck from the factory felt a lot more secure than whether or not the crop was going to come in. My great-grandfather, I was telling you, was a sharecropper. He saved up enough money by the time my granddad was 13. They moved 11 times by the time my granddad was 13. And he saved up enough money to buy 40 acres. And so they moved out there to that 40 acres. It's his own 40 acres. Now he can actually keep all of the proceeds that come off the land, and he got sick. And they could not get the seed in at the right time. And so when it came time for harvest, he had to hire himself, his wife, and his two oldest sons out to pick cotton for other people, still making profits for other people and having the leftovers in order to just survive. My granddad said, you know, we weren't going out there and picking cotton so that we could have nice toys. We were just going out and picking cotton so we could have a coat put on our back. And the shirts that they wore were made out of the sacks that the flour came in. He said, you know, you'd wind up coming home with dumplings under your armpits. That's free right there. So, well, that's a different life, isn't it? And my great-granddad looked at that and he said, you know, if I get sick for 3 weeks, I go home and then I go right back to work at the Ford Motor Company, they'll keep paying me. You know, it isn't a disaster like it is in farming. And if it rains at the wrong time, there's a roof over that garage and I can keep fixing cars. And if it doesn't rain for a whole month, that doesn't matter to me if I'm fixing cars. I'm going to tell you what, I grew up completely disconnected from any thought of the blessing of rain. I don't know about you, but in fact, not only did I grow up disconnected from the thought of rain being a blessing, but when I started doing construction work, rain was the last thing I wanted to see. Like, when you're doing construction work, rain's the enemy. The whole point of construction work is to figure out how to keep the water out. And so, like, there was never a day where it rained that I was thankful. Do you know that's a peculiar way to live for most of human history? Most people throughout history lived with a constant sense of dependence upon what God provided. But we made factories and we solved that problem. And now we don't have to worry if it rains, right? Somebody does, but not you and me. So we got a little bit disconnected from that dependency and we thought certain paychecks is much more secure. Never mind that the person who provides you with those paychecks also says you got to buy from the company store and they'll make sure that you buy more than you ever get and you will owe your soul to the company store, as the man sings. You know that song? Okay, good. That's what that means. You buy on credit. You go down in the coal mine and risk your life, and when you come back out, he says, hey, you want some food to eat? You can buy it on credit. You need a house to live? You can buy it on credit. You need some clothes for your kids? You can buy it on credit. Oh, guess what? Your paycheck's gone. And you'll die in debt. So, but it solved the problem, didn't it? Now the work's outside the home, and not only is the work outside the home, but work has a price tag. A very specific and tangible price tag. You can point to how many dollars an hour you are worth. When we were working in the home, that wasn't quite as tangible, right? You couldn't put your work into a test tube and measure it, its value. You maybe could from the standpoint of what you sold, but a lot of the work you were doing is feeding your kids. Can you put a price tag on that? Taking care of your family, what's that worth to you? How many dollars an hour is that worth to you? But you go out and now somebody else has said, this is how many dollars an hour of your life is worth. Do you think that changed the way we thought about people and about how they function in society? I'll tell you what else it did. It changed the way we thought about what women were doing. Because while men went out in the home and they could point to their paycheck and say, I'm worth this many dollars an hour, a woman is doing work on which we could not put price. And instead of thinking that must mean that her worth, her value is incalculable, we said it must not be worth very much. And it's truly. I mean, and I don't mean that just in a general sense. I mean, people actually put that on paper. That is what feminists were writing. They were the ones saying that if a woman is not making money, then she really doesn't have tangible value in this world. Because that's what the Industrial Revolution did, is make people think of a person's worth in terms of how much money, how much profit they could produce. Not only that, but in fact, a lot of the jobs that she used to do are now gone. Right? So, I mean, in a very real sense, much of her very purposeful and very clearly valuable work is now in a factory somewhere. And so she's left with less to do. Now, you might say, well, that would make her life easier, wouldn't it? Maybe in some ways. But I want to suggest to you, women's lives got a lot harder in other ways. Now, on the one hand, I was going through a museum one time, I think it was in Williamsburg, and they were wanting to convey the plight of slaves, which I think is a valuable thing to contemplate. But The way that they conveyed this, I thought was almost comical. They said, here's this woman who was a slave, lived in here, and she got up when the sun came up, or even before the sun came up, and immediately her work began, and it didn't stop till she went to bed. And I was like, you mean like most women through all of human history? Like, that's not unique to a slave's life. That is, the only women in history who that's not true of is women who had servants doing those things for them. Most women got up when the sun came up, or before the sun came up, and their work was continued on after the sun went down. I was talking to a fellow about some of these things the other day, and he said, my great-grandmother, said when she got up in the morning, every morning she made 100 biscuits from scratch. Hey, you know, I was reading something this guy said, talked about burning the biscuits and everything. He said, you know, we think that's unimportant. He says, listen, making biscuits, that's God's work. And it is. But maybe not in the way we think. She got up and she provided vital service to fill the bellies of the men who are about to walk out the door and provide the things that made life possible. Now she's been reduced to a domestic servant who decorates the house. I was reading something about women's work. You ever heard that? Who's heard the term wall-to-wall carpet? Yeah. Some of you younger guys may not have heard that term. I grew up, of course, a house had carpet or it didn't. And every once in a while you hear an older person say, does it have wall-to-wall carpet? I'm like, what? Why would you stop short of the wall? But a rug's what they were talking about in comparison to a rug that doesn't go wall-to-wall. And that's used to be, that was, if you had carpet, that's what you had. Nobody had wall-to-wall carpet. You just had a carpet in the middle of the house. And when you needed to clean that, how'd they do that? Take it outside and beat it. Guess who rolled that thing and picked it up? Most likely. Dad. That's a big old heavy thing. Guess who beat it? Whole family. Together. That was a family activity. Now the family's gone. And you hand her a vacuum cleaner. Now, is that physically easier? To vacuum that rug up? To vacuum that wall-to-wall carpet up? Maybe, in some ways. Do you think it's spiritually better? What do you think? Do you think a wife gains as much from being by herself vacuuming that up or being out there with her family and the whole family's involved in this aspect and dad's doing his part and then she's doing her part? I don't think that her life got spiritually better. I think, like men, something was lost along the way. The woman whose many of her jobs have been taken away, not only that, but the people have been taken away. The husband who was there guiding and leading and administering is gone. He works away. The children who were around about, they're gone off to school. The grandparents and aunts and uncles who used to surround, they're gone. Now she's alone. And this was another reason that women said, this is not fair. It's not fair to us what's happened. Children leaving the homes to go be educated, that's obviously good, right? Nothing better than a federal education. So he took them out of the home because they need to be educated to live life in this new world. How did they learn anything before? I'll tell you what, they learned everything they knew, everything they needed to know by stepping right alongside their dad and their mother. And they learned how the household functioned, which was the way they were going to live their life because they were going to take up the trade of their father. And maybe if there wasn't room in that household, then their father would find some other man and say, hey, here's a man who will teach you a trade, and I'm going to pay him for you to work for him. You'll be his apprentice. And when you're done, you'll know how to have something that you can use to provide for your household and be an asset and so forth. Marshall was telling me there was this story in the paper. I think, wasn't it you telling me about the kids being taken away from the folks that were abusing them? They really were abusing them. They were putting them in cages and I don't know what else. But the real gotcha line in the story was they were making these kids do farm work. Buddy, don't come to my house. That was the evidence of the abuse of these children. I'm going to tell you what. I would trade every minute of a public education for a year spent on a farm. I think that we have lost far more than we've gained, and we're losing more still by moving to a sense of this is where kids are truly educated. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't see any value in the things that are conveyed in an educational system. I think, though, we've pretended it's of far greater importance than it actually is. It should be like supplementary. Yeah, those are some good things to learn, but I tell you what you really need to learn. And I'll even say this, even STEM, you know, all the math and science. I'll tell you what, my daughter came home, she school's at home. But anyway, she came to me one day and she's like, we're in calculus. She goes, Dad, why on earth do I need to understand how to calculate the area of a sphere? And I had done pretty good up to that point kind of explaining to her like why geometry is necessary and so forth. I'm like, I mean, it'll build character. I couldn't say, let me tell you all the times I've used that in my life. I don't know. And meanwhile, you know, with all of that advanced levels of math, not a single person knows how to do their taxes. Now, granted, that's more complicated than calculus. But, yeah, for preachers especially. But, you know, truly, they're not teaching kids how to live. They used to teach home economics, right? That's the very thing we're talking about, home economics. Anybody in here take home economics? I did. Why did you take home economics? Huh? Absolutely. It certainly was not to learn home economics. Maybe it was to create home economics. Yeah, consumer science, that's right. Yeah, so they did away with that term, didn't they? All right, so now we've emptied out the home and we've made it an empty shell, quite literally, of what it used to be. Here's a woman there by herself with most of her jobs taken away, and don't take this to mean that I think there's no work for a woman to do in the home now. I don't mean that. I just mean that most of what the woman had done through human history no longer naturally exists in the home. And so many of the people around her have been removed, and now you have a perfect storm. Men are at work all day, and the place that they're at work is not a family environment. Factories are not conducive to moral uplifting, edification. Minds are not places men go to think lofty thoughts. And so they are coarsened, and not only are they coarsened, but they are beat down. And when men leave that place that has not been morally, emotionally, physically uplifting, they need a break, or at least they feel like they need a break. Guess where they went? To the bar. To the brothel. During this period of history, the number of saloons hit an all-time high. The number of people consuming alcohol just consuming alcohol was in some places twice as much, in some places three times as much what it is now. So I don't say that we don't have a drinking problem, but they had an even worse drinking problem, which, incidentally, leads you to the early 1900s, and you go, this whole prohibition movement, boy, that was a boneheaded movement, wasn't it? We could argue, we could debate whether that was boneheaded, but I'm going to tell you what, women were desperate to have some sober husbands who would come home and take care of their families. But that also goes back to why they were doing that in the first place. I'm not excusing them. I'm not excusing men for going to drink and to sexual gratification. But I do want to suggest to you there were motives that pushed them in that direction. So men are outside the home. They're not only outside the home, but they're looking for relief in sinful ways. So now when they do come home, even the ones who actually come home, they're exhausted both physically and emotionally. And so what's the expectation of the wife? She's got to fix it all, doesn't she? She better have a happy home ready for him because she's not exhausted, right? She hasn't been doing the kind of work he's been doing. And so have a meal prepared, have the children quiet and ready to greet their father. Go get his shoes and put some slippers there, bring his newspaper that he can read. And so he becomes a guest in his home who is to be treated with eggshells and delicacy and put on the pedestal. Now he is not the leader of the home. Now he is, maybe at best, an honored guest in his home. She's expected to repair all of the damage done to her man during the workday. Can I suggest to you everyone's lives got spiritually and emotionally harder at the very time where all these labor-saving life improvements were telling people that your life is better than it's ever been? Well, there's a way that that's true. It's certainly physically easier than it's ever been in some ways. But it's not emotionally easier. It's not spiritually easier. Because we lost a lot of the things, a lot of the natural ways that spiritual lessons were infused into our lives. We were told life was better than it had ever been before, but it didn't feel like it. And it still doesn't. It hadn't gotten better. The new norm, then, we just adjusted. And the new norm became Leave It to Beaver. That's that ideal picture, right? June and Ward Cleaver. 2.5 children. Happy family. Dad goes off to a nice office job. We kind of put those factory jobs where everybody was literally killing themselves to try to get a dollar over there in the corner. We're not going to talk about all that. We got a nice office job for Dad. He spends all of his time away from home. He comes home, and the family, everything's well ordered, and he comes in and has conversations with his children, maybe administers a little bit of discipline and so forth. Even then, you could see that things were not what they needed to be. Ward Cleaver was a bit bumbling in the way he handled things with his children. Fathers became strangers in their homes. Where they had been the centerpiece of the home, now they are the one who comes in. Life has been being lived with mom and the children all day, and now the husband comes in, and he's been living in foreign territory. And he comes in and he's not part of the daily and normal flow of the home anymore. And his interactions are a little bit clumsy. And he doesn't know how to relate to these kids. I've been working side by side, not with family members. I've been working side by side with Joe. And man, if you're going to work side by side by him, you better be a pretty hard guy. And that began, that just planted the seeds. You know, people say, why do we always make husbands out to be the buffoons? Because husbands did become buffoons in their homes. Because they did become the butt of jokes. Dad doesn't understand. You know, you ever been somewhere where somebody, where people have just known each other all their lives and they're talking about all sorts of things and they're making inside joke references and you're just like Michael Scott, inside jokes, I love inside jokes. I'd love to be a part of one someday, you know. A dad comes home and he doesn't know the inside jokes. You think that's a small thing? It's not. He's an outsider in his own home. And so that's where we are. That's the place that we've come to is we got to that new normal. And not only did we get to that new normal, then when things started actually, you know, breaking down in serious ways, we did two things. First of all, we instead of saying, I tell you what, we really messed things up. No, we pointed back to the new normal. We pointed back to June and Ward Cleaver and said, if we could just hold on to that, if we could just keep hold of this idyllic picture, which was not an idyllic picture. It wasn't the ideal home. It wasn't the household that God wants you to make you a part of. It was already a distortion. It was already broken in serious ways. And instead of saying, let's figure out what happened and what went wrong, they said, you know what? This is silly for us to try to paint the picture of this ideal home. Let's paint the picture of the real home. And we got Roseanne. What a lovely picture that was. And then they painted that picture realizing it's not great, but it's what is. I mean, it's kind of like people actually live. So we'll present that and we'll laugh at it and make light of it. Then they went on and said, actually, all of these broken homes, these sexually perverse relationships, they're actually the norm. And we got Modern Family. In which case, you got multiple types of family. Right, it's all different kinds of families. And they're presented as, this is fine. This is okay. However you want to do it, that's fine. I want to suggest to you that even if we can't get back to the idyllic picture, we at least need to reestablish what it looks like, to understand what it looks like. And by doing so, even if we can't get back there, maybe we can figure out the pieces and parts that were valuable and try to come up with some way to at least recoup those. Can we make sure that we're not losing the things that provided that were good? You say, you know, it's just impossible for, you know, at large, for society to just turn back the clock. It is. Like, I don't think we're going back to 1750. And frankly, at this point, we just like air conditioning too much. It's not happening. But I think the major problem is that when we got to June and Ward Cleaver, we didn't just say, this is the new norm and we'll just have to deal with it. What we said was, this is the new norm and it's so much better than the old. And we didn't ask the questions of, why is it better? Why do we think that this is so much smarter and so much better and so much more improved than what we had before? Is it because we think that basically everybody that's lived from Adam until George Washington just didn't have the brain capacity that we have? Go watch an interview on the street. Our brain capacity is not what we make it out to be. We are not so enlightened as we think. So what do we need to recoup? That's what our next couple of lessons will be. Trying to identify words, trying to identify places where God says, here is an element, here is a characteristic, here is something, and then we can see how that would have been naturally attached to the home. And we figure out, okay, we don't have the natural part of that anymore. But we can still have the spiritual part. We can still have the spiritual value that went along with that thing. Let's say arranged marriages, for instance. I don't think we're going back to contractual relationships where we form that at the beginning stages, though I've had a couple of offers. But could we, maybe, get parents a lot more involved in their children choosing their spouses than they have been? Could we maybe say that an 18-year-old is not going to be as thoughtful as her 40-year-old father in thinking about who she should spend the rest of her life with? I will say that I've tried to communicate this to my daughters. And I just relate this to you. My younger daughter, she's heard all of these things. She's heard me preach these things, and both in the pulpit and in the living room. And so she comes up. She recently broke up with a boy that she's had a relationship with that we appreciate him, and we've talked through all of that. But I told her, I said, you're really young. She's 18 now, but I said, you're really young, and you maybe wish you didn't get as close as you're getting right now. So the other day I came in, she told me she broke up with him, and she goes, well, she didn't say that. She's just crying. I said, what's wrong, baby? And she goes, you were right. And I said, you know, I'm so sorry. You know. But she said, you know, I do wish I could just, you could just go find someone and just tell me when they're ready. And I don't have to worry about this anymore. And I was like, I pulled out the contract. Sign right here. Maybe we don't go all the way back to official arranged marriages, but could we raise our children to look to us and say, help me. Help me figure this out. And I think, in fact, sometimes children are looking to their parents in a situation like that saying, help me. But we've been so acclimated to say, that's your choice. That's your choice. I'm not a part of that decision. Why? Why would you stay out of that? Because culture has told you something about that that's not true. That you shouldn't be involved in those decisions. I mean, that is a modern and foolish notion. And we need to recover the wisdom of the ages, of our forefathers. Figure out who they are. Abraham, Paul tells us, is our forefather. We can look at how he lived his life. And instead of scoffing and just saying, oh, well, that was back then, back when they didn't know much, we can say, Abraham was the forefather. He is the prototype. I think I can learn something from him. I can learn something from all of these men and women who loved and served God through the ages and did so in ways, in homes that look very different from ours. And so we're going to try to do some recovery work over the next couple of days, and I hope that'll be helpful. Are there any questions? We got just a couple of minutes. Pushback. Yeah.
Certain your children see you love and love. You're right. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people have trouble with that. We're raised to be independent, strong. We don't show emotion. Big boys don't do what? They don't cry.
Yeah.
And we need to.
Yeah, we do. And at the same time, so here's along those lines. Let them see you love your mother. There was a time when they got to see that all day. Now, they see you, hopefully, doing it, but doing it in a way that so often requires tremendous effort for you to put away all of the pent-up feelings that you're coming in the door with, and you have to. And this is where I would say balance on that you need to cry. They do need to see a man be emotionally invested and involved And they also need to see a man who does not allow his emotions to rule him. And I think we are off on both counts. I think we have people who are too emotionally disconnected, and I think we have people who are ruled by their emotions. What we don't have is emotionally stable men who know that even sometimes when they want to cry, now is not the time. Now I have to do my duty. I'll give you an example. I was in the yard with Rylan the other day. We're pulling weeds. It was hot. And, you know, I'm not a terribly hard taskmaster on a four-year-old, but I expect him to pull, you know, a couple of weeds every 5 minutes or so. And so he was like, he'll pull two or three weeds, and he'll go, whew, I need some water. I'm like, yeah, that's fine, you know. So at one point he goes, Dad, I'm tired. And I said, I am too, but the work's not done. And that's an opportunity that most of us don't get. Because when we're tired and the work's not done, our son's not right there to talk about that. And so I let him know that it's not that Dad's not tired. It's not that Dad's not hurt, that Dad's not excited, that he's not... But there's things to do, even in the midst of all of that. Rick?
I'm wondering about some of these pictures. It seems like we can mess up even some of the old pictures. So for example, in Sierra Leone, they father's arranged marriage, but it's arranged. Many of them are arranged because this is financially beneficial.
Okay.
And if the guy doesn't come through with the dowry, we just take him away from that woman or that man. We give her to another man. So there's ways in which those things can be messed up.
Yeah.
I think even when we look at Abraham, we see this great, but what about his relationship with Hagar?
Right.
And that was, I think, something that would have been culturally acceptable.
Yeah.
But it was clearly not God's plan.
Okay.
We have to sort of, don't we still have to?
Absolutely. So here's what I want to say about that. When we see the breakdown in a marriage and it doesn't have love, you know, we've fallen out of love, what is our solution? Divorce. Is that God's solution? No, right? So we say, you're going to, if you don't allow divorce, then you're going to demand that a woman stays in a hard and difficult relationship. Yes. Because I think the alternative is even worse. So one of the things I want to say about these patterns and these things that we can gain is, yes, there are abuses, and yes, there are perversions along the way, and we need to weed through that and figure out what's perversions and what's good pattern. But I also want to say, like with arranged marriages, our assumption, because we see that some men are in it for this, is that all men are in it for this. You think that men through the ages who have arranged marriages, none of them love their daughters like you do? You know, that's what I think we think. And it's like, you know, basically all men before us were bad. People love their kids. They arrange marriages because they love their kids. Not because they were all wicked and only self-absorbed. Now, were there self-absorbed men who abused that very practice? Sure. But so what we've done is we've said, because I can see abuses in the way God has patterned things and the way God has designed things, we will set His design aside and put something else in its place and not admit the abuses that are occurring there. So that's one of the arguments for homosexual marriage, right? I mean, you want to talk to me about homosexual marriage, look at the state of heterosexual marriages in America. Right. There's a way to fix those. There is not a way to fix the homosexual marriage. Right? See, I can still point to the heterosexual marriage and say they are off track, but they could get right back on real easy. You're not even on the tracks and never could. Your train won't run on the tracks. No. It's not going the wrong way. It's over in the field on its side, right? It's a different thing. It cannot function in the way that a marriage functions. Let me say this about marriage. When we reduce it down to emotional connection, we have laid the groundwork on which the Supreme Court decided that homosexual marriage should be allowed. Because everybody should be allowed to love who they want to love. If we had maintained the functional definitions of marriage, then what everybody could see is you are not able to complete the function of marriage. And so the reasoning of the Supreme Court, the decision as it's written out, would be nonsense. But when we reduced it to an emotional, like, yeah, they deserve to have emotional connection just like we deserve to have emotional connection. That's not fundamentally what a marriage is. It is commitment, and it is a commitment that involves function. And we'll talk more about that as we talk about what we are going to try to recover. Okay. Appreciate your time.